Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
It's my pleasure to be with you all this morning, have a chance to look into this question of the interpretation of Scripture in relationship to the data of various academic disciplines. As all of us here are Christians engaged in teaching in Christian institutions of higher education, we're really, as a part of our responsibility, involved in seeking to know what God's mind is in regard to our own particular academic discipline. Now, in speaking this morning, I'd like to make a distinction between what we might call a creative academic discipline and an investigative academic discipline. A creative academic discipline would be one in which someone is producing something new out of his own mind, I suppose. For instance, an artist drawing a picture, or a person writing a piece of literature, or an engineer designing some new apparatus, or a general or president or someone making history. And on the other hand, an investigative discipline is not so much making up something that is new, but trying to find out how something is that already exists. So in place of an artist making art, the investigative discipline that might correspond to that would be art criticism or art history or something like that, where you're trying to find out what it is exists and who did it and what they had in mind and things of that variety. And corresponding to writing, there would of course be literary criticism, trying to find out what you can about the author and what he intended. And corresponding to engineering, perhaps people making gadgets, I'm not quite sure what the investigative discipline would be, perhaps engineering history or something of that variety. I have science, but science is in a sense not an attempt to find out what men have made exactly, it's more an attempt to find out what God has made and understand that. But still, it's somewhat over on the investigative side, let's say. And corresponding perhaps to making history would be studying history, finding out what has happened, what the actors had in mind, things of that variety. Well, this series, the interpretation of Scripture in relationship to the data of various academic disciplines, we'll try and confine ourselves to the matter of interpreting Scripture in relationship to the investigative disciplines. Not that there aren't people doing the other type of work at universities, but that really the work of college and university is basically that of investigating what exists in the world around us, both in regard to what men have done, what regard to God have done. So that's the area we will stick. That's what I'll mean basically then about by academic disciplines here. Not saying, of course, that there's not in these other things I've mentioned, science and such, creative aspects to what the person is doing, but that the emphasis is upon finding out how things are, rather than producing something that's never existed before. Now, I'm a little scared about giving a talk in this direction, because no matter what I talk about, there's doubtless someone in this room who knows more about it than I do. And that's one of the dangers of doing any kind of interdisciplinary work. What I'll try and do is lecture for somewhere in the order of magnitude of an hour. For those of us in physics, order of magnitude means between one-tenth of an hour and 10 hours. And that's order of magnitude an hour. So I'll try and say what I can, and then after I've gotten through a presentation, then you may attack or make comments or ask questions or things of that variety. My own background, as Dr. Barkat pointed out, is mostly in the area of science and in the area of theology, broadly understood. Never had too much academic work in English or history or social studies or philosophy, so you can see how bad this is going to be already. But basically, intention is to look at this matter of interpreting Scripture in the light of the data that we in our own particular academic discipline will be familiar with, and trying to figure out how to interrelate these things. The goal of this series is not to exhaust the topic, so that's certainly not going to happen. It's not even going to be very detailed, because I'm not that kind of a person. Some persons as scholars are very meticulous and detailed, and they work thoroughly. I'm very fast and such, so I have no trouble publishing things, they're just not any good, and that sort of thing. Other people, they never publish much, but boy, it's really good. Well, here we go. My procedure is to zip over things and try and look at big pictures and that sort of thing. Also, I'll be trying to stimulate you, cause you to think about certain things, maybe suggest some ideas to you, rather than solving all our problems. The basic idea here is to divide up this general subject, interpreting Scripture. How you use your Bible when you're working, how about that? Our topic I'll divide that up into three areas, scientific model making and biblical exegesis for this morning. This afternoon, some theological considerations, and then tomorrow, basically a matter of putting the things together. How do we do an interdisciplinary model making, and what does a critical synthesis consist of? Well, this morning then, let's have a look at our first topic, scientific model making and biblical exegesis. Want to look first of all then at scientific model making. I have a little diagram here that's intended to represent scientific model making. Doubtless there are many such designs that could be made, but this one I think picks up a few of the areas that are involved. We have first of all what we might call data, and that would be the information that is in our particular academic area. Although I call this scientific model making, I don't understand that this is limited science at all, but this type of procedure is in fact something that I think would characterize every investigative discipline. Every discipline where you are not trying to make something new, you're trying to find out how things are. Whether this area be linguistics, whether it be literary criticism, whether it be philosophy, history, whatever, you're involved in model making. And basically, you start out with the material that's given. Unfortunately, in spite of the hand sticking down, usually when you start into this work, there's not a hand sticking out there to drop it in your lap. You may have to go out and scrounge around for it a little bit. But still, it is the material that's given to us that is a representation of the reality we're trying to describe. By a process called induction, one of the several ways that are classically representative knowing, we look at this information we have, whether it be the information of science or a social science or a humanities area where we're doing investigative work, and we try and see what among this whole mass of data can be abstracted out of it to be said to be generally true. And we might want to construct these in the form of some verbal statements. Might not always be verbal, though. They might be mathematical statements, or they might be pictorial in some way. But basically, we try from the data that we're given to taking the multitude of particulars and reducing them to a smaller multitude of rather generalized concepts. And I call these generalizations. Then, moving on from there, we try to figure out how to put those together into some structure that interrelates many of these ideas, and perhaps will involve some speculative aspect to it of showing how these different things fit together. And the result of these putting these generalizations together so they hang together in something which has a relationship to it is a model. A model is something that is usually a scaled-down version of the reality you're trying to picture. And yet it is supposed to represent a large number of the features that actually exist in the reality. The method by which you get from generalizations to a model cannot be described in any very satisfactory way. I think it's fair to say that the method by which one goes from one to the other is a method that in ways of knowing has often been scoffed at, the method of intuition. The idea that somehow it just pops into your mind that these things fit together. We think perhaps of the structure of the DNA molecule, where the investigator, while he was dreaming, he saw a double helix in his mind, and he went out and tried that out, and sure enough. And apparently it had something to do with the information he already knew about, the generalizations he had made, and yet it just sort of popped out while he wasn't even consciously thinking about what was going on. From the model, which, as I say, might be totally verbal, might be totally mathematical, might be mechanical even, one tries to apply logical principles and produce from that a group of statements that would be somewhat like the generalizations, except they might contain many things that you did not actually have in your generalizations when you made them up. And yet they would perhaps, again, take the form of written statements, or they might take the form of diagrams or something of that variety. And these things are what we call predictions. They are things that must follow if this model is correct. But you don't know whether they're things that are really true about reality because you do not know how well your model fits reality. And then having these predictions, you use a procedure of trying to compare them to the data. Do they really fit the data? So this is a rather quick explanation of model making. We could call it scientific model making, but in fact, it's the same procedure that would be used in any investigative discipline. Notice that although we often call the scientific method the inductive method, that in fact induction is only one small part of it, and four or five methods of knowing are actually involved in this whole procedure. We have induction, the taking of many items and reducing them to a fewer number of generalizations. But we also have deduction, the taking of some structure, logical structure, and working out from it many statements that follow from it. We have intuition, and this is in fact the trickiest step, I think, in the scientific method or in the method of investigative model making. And we also have, I think, a way of knowing, although I've not seen the term used, maybe there's another term used for it in philosophy, and that is comparison. Taking two things and seeing the similarity, see how they agree or disagree with one another. In fact, comparison is a very important feature even in measurement. But this gives you a little picture of these various ways. There's another rather standard method of knowing that's not even mentioned here, but which is very, very important in model making. It's a method of authority. We're almost never in a situation where we have immediate access to all of the data that we need in our field. Almost always, that data is communicated to us from many other sources, which we therefore depend upon to begin our model making. So we depend upon authority very frequently right here, even if we're doing the whole thing. If we are a theoretician, we may in fact only start here and work on trying to make models. Experimentalist might be working over in this area almost totally. Different types of investigators in a discipline might concentrate on one part of the cycle rather than all parts of the cycle. But we see, I think, that model making is a rather complicated thing, and it's not a mechanistic thing. It's not a mechanistic thing at all. As far as I know, there are no real principles you can use to decide how to make that step, and yet that's the most crucial step. How do you get from certain generalizations to a picture that might cause them to hang together? And there are many possibilities there. Notice also in this design here that we have a cycle to it. It's a cyclic structure. In principle, you can go back around again. You looking at the data, you make some generalizations from it, you get some ideas that may suggest a model, you draw some deductions from that model, which make predictions about the data. You compare them with the data. You may notice some problems that require you to go back and make some new generalizations that you didn't have before. You may come across some data that you didn't have first time around. A number of things might happen that would cause you to go back around the circle again. So we have a cyclic structure here. The structure is somewhat self-checking. Somewhat self-checking. Your predictions, then compared with the data, tell you whether things are awry or whether things are going pretty well. You are, in many disciplines, able to experiment. That's not true in all disciplines, certainly. But there are many investigative disciplines where you're able to experiment, where you are able to say, well, these predictions suggest some things, but I've never done anything to the data to see whether that could be true or not. I have to try and simplify the situation or something. Now, many of the scientific areas, not all of them, many of the scientific areas, you can do that. Some other areas, you can do that. Linguistics. You can go back out into the field and begin to ask questions of your informant and see whether some things you got some ideas about really hold up in that language or whether you're on the wrong track. Well, we see, I think, a feature that is somewhat self-checking there. So prediction helps us to be self-checking. Experiment helps us to be self-checking. But there's some areas where you can't experiment. Astronomy, you can't experiment very well. You can take a few things into the laboratory, but suns don't behave in the laboratory very well. Don't fit. Problems of pressure, temperature, things of that variety. And often you're dealing with time scales that you can't bring into the laboratory. So history, similar situation. You can go out and dig around a great deal to see if you can come up with any more documents or archaeological information that might help you solve a historical problem, but it may happen that the information available to solve that problem doesn't even exist anymore. And so you can't directly experiment, but other times you can. Certainly a rather important area in history and a number of other areas is predictions made on the basis of amount of data available at some time, and then new data turns up. And if it bombs out your predictions rather badly, then something was awry with that particular model. And so prediction, experiment, and the addition of new data are all valuable things in making this somewhat self-checking. Now, in actual practice, when you have a whole community of people working in some particular area, you often have several models competing with one another in the same area. Several different explanations for how these things are to be solved. Is the universe, let's say cosmology, is the universe a universe which has always existed, or did it come to pass, come into existence at a finite time in the past? Is it expanding? Is it static? Is it contracting? Is new matter coming into existence, or is the amount of matter that's there the same it's been there before? Things of that variety. There are many, many different disciplines. You've got different suggestions. Who wrote Shakespeare? Was it William Shakespeare? Francis Bacon? Was it, there's some other guys floating around out there. But different models that might be suggested. Some of the models might be very popular. Some of the models might be pure crackpot stuff. But and once in a while, crackpot models turn out to be right. Rarely, of course, compared with the number that exist. But it happens occasionally. Basically, one tries to see if they can select a best model for the particular situation you've got. Let's look at the model selection in an idealized way, first of all, and then look at some complications that arise and come back and see if we can repair this whole matter of model selection later. So, just a word or two about model selection idealized. When you talk about the investigative method of model making, generally you think, well, a model must fit the data. Well, that's one thing. It must fit the data. So here's the data. You draw sufficient number of generalizations, you construct a tentative model, you go back and make predictions, compare it. If it doesn't fit, that model's no good. If it does fit, great. It has to fit the data, and that's what the last half of this cycle is for, to see whether it does. The first half is to design it so it does, and the second half is see whether you really designed what you hoped you had. Well, there's another thing that's often used in model making, and that is this. That almost no matter what kind of a model you make down here, it's easy to think of slight changes in it that will still fit all the data. Or maybe it's hard to think of them, but somebody will think of them eventually. So you might have a bunch of models that are almost identical, but with little variations on them. And then you may have a couple of models that are even very drastically different, but they still seem to fit the data. What do you do? How do you choose among these? It's been rather common to use Occam's razor. Occam's razor is a principle that one tries to get by with the simplest explanation possible that fits the data. Occam's razor, in fact, eliminates at least an infinity of competing models. When you think in mathematical terms for a model, you can add all sorts of terms to the mathematics that are zero within the whole range of the data you've ever looked at and begin to do funny things outside the range you've done. There's an infinity of those. And so by Occam's razor, you eliminate those and you work with the simplest one. So in the idealized picture of constructing a model in an academic area, you try and construct a model that fits all the data you know about, and you try to make it as simple as possible by means of Occam's razor. Well, before we look at some problems which will arise in selecting models, we should look at the question of levels of explanation. When you make a model like this, you may run around the cycle several times and finally decide you've got a reasonable model for what you're trying to explain. And somebody who's working in a slightly different area of your same field has made a model for some phenomenon he's looking at. And a third person working in a slightly other different area, he's made a model for some area. And then you say, well, can we somehow put these models together and make a greater synthesis, something that's even more explanatory than these? These explain these regions of data. Now we want something to explain them all. You can imagine a situation in which you go to next higher level where the data are the models that have been constructed by various persons working in allied areas. And you're going to try and make some generalizations with them and make a model that fits us all together. We think of Isaac Newton sitting under the apple tree, allegedly, on vacation from college, and an apple falls, whether it hit him on the head or just dropped on the ground beside him or not. It suggested a way of fitting together views of gravity, that things that are up must fall down, and also explaining some of Kepler's laws regarding the motion of planets around the sun. And he put these together into a more overarching explanation called gravity, in which he explained that the same phenomenon that caused the apple to fall from the tree was causing the moon to fall from the sky, except the moon happened to be moving in the right direction fast enough that as it fell, it kept slipping around the edge and never quite made it down to the Earth, but stayed out in an elliptical orbit. Well, be an example of making a model, which depends, as its data, perhaps largely on models, rather than so much on direct measurements, things of that variety. In fact, this sort of phenomenon seems to be characteristic of all of our investigative disciplines. I think it's due to the fact that we live in a very complicated universe, and we live in a universe where both explanation or causation, I'm using them somewhat synonymously, tend to be not only chain-like, cause back here, which produces an effect here, which becomes a cause to produce an effect, cause, effect, etc. down the line. But also they're web-like, that 50,000 causes out here come down to produce one effect. Of course, they're producing all sorts of effects over here as well. And so there's a great interaction between all of these different events that are going on. When we ask a simple question like, what makes it rain? We have, in fact, quite a multitude of answers that can be given on different levels or from different perspectives. So let me see if I can illustrate that here. We might say, well, what makes it rain? Well, rain is water falling from the sky. There we have some water, and the gravity of the Earth is pulling it down. See? So your child asks you, what makes it rain? You might say, well, the Earth pulls that water down. Where does it come from? Well, it comes from the clouds. Move up the clouds. And the kid, persistent, might ask you, how does it get there? Well, let's see. There's a thermal gradient, you probably wouldn't want to tell them that. The temperature goes down as you go up higher and higher, and air that's down here near the ground has got certain humidity, rises because it's been heated. As it cools off, the humidity gets higher and higher until it gets up to 100%, it forms fog up there in the sky. That's the clouds. You say, well, let's see, if rain is water falling from the sky, what holds clouds up? Gravity's down there, pull the water down, or pull the clouds down. Why the clouds stay up there? Well, then you have to explain how the water is divided into very small particles, and those particles small enough, the molecular motion in the air will keep them up there. And having explained that, then why does it fall down? Now, well, you've got it up there now. Why does it fall down? Back to that problem. Well, then you have to explain that certain dust particles may occur in the clouds, and the stuff can form larger droplets around these dust particles, and once the droplets reach a certain size, they will fall. And we skipped over something, and that is, why does this humid air rise? I said something about heating up, and you have to get back up there and then talk about the sun. So when you ask what makes it rain, you can say, water makes it rain, or you can say, gravity makes it rain, or clouds make it rain, or thermal gradient makes it rain, or humid air rising makes it rain, or the dust particles make it rain, or the sun makes it rain. We haven't finished yet. You can back up behind that and say nuclear fusion makes it rain, because the sun wouldn't be shining if it weren't for these hydrogen atoms combining into helium atoms and giving off energy that in the center of the sun that produces the sun. And as you work your way back, you'll finally get back that God is the cause of this. And what we're really looking at is we're looking at levels of explanation, all of which are true and really represent, in a sense, different levels of models in a model-making scheme. God is not necessarily furthest away, but when we're thinking in a chain of causality, there might be a sense in which he is. Of course, God is responsible for the nature of gravity and the nature of air and the reason why you get a thermal gradient in an atmosphere under gravity, depending on the cloudiness and for why there's dust and various other complications as well. So putting him out there is probably not totally satisfactory, but just intended to show you a little something of this whole complicated area of levels of explanation. And science starts with the given, starts with the observable, etc., and basically tries to work to higher and higher levels of generalization, which basically means less and less directly observable. And I think any of our investigative disciplines would do the same thing. Before you can ask what motivated Napoleon to invade Russia, you really need to find out whether he did or not. And there are certain groundwork that has to be done in history before you get back to certain much more basic explanations. And same thing, I think, in any investigative disciplines. We can see then that one complication with model making will be the complexity of the universe and the fact that there are a great number of levels of model making, and some complication of trying to limit our investigation to construct a model that will really make sense before we begin to move up the line too fast. The data we have might be at a very low level and not capable at that point of making a very high generalization regarding exactly what God is doing, for instance. Well, another problem we have in the area of model making is problems with the data. I've just got it given here. You know, there's the hand stuck out. You reach out and pull it off and generalize it. But there can be a number of different data problems you can have. One of the most difficult ones is what we might call faulty data. Now, if you define data right, there's no such thing as faulty data. At least I believe in the inerrancy of data. What do I mean by that? Well, I believe that since it's the real world you're trying to explain, and data are features of the real world, then shouldn't be any such thing as faulty data. But when we use the word data, we normally mean the information we've got to work with when we begin to try and make our model, whether they be readings on an oscilloscope or whether they be words our informant has given us when we're trying to do something with explaining some language that's never been reduced to writing, something of that sort. And in those cases, you can very well have faulty data. You can have data that was mismeasured. There's the real world, here's your equipment, and it was mismeasured. It may have been mismeasured because the scale that you thought you had on your ohmmeter wasn't the right size scale, and you read it for something and it's 10 times larger. Or it might be mismeasured because you just weren't wide awake when you were doing that particular job. It might be misreported. That guy measured it right, but when it got to you, it's fouled up again. Perhaps a typist in preparing the manuscript of the paper typed something wrong, comes across incorrectly. Or it might be misunderstood in some way. You're taking something to be data when in fact it is an interpretation that was not the only possible interpretation, in fact turned out to be the wrong interpretation of that particular piece of information. And as a result, you have some faulty data up here. Now, if there's anything that'll foul up making a correct model, it's having data that from which you're making generalizations and inducing a model and making predictions that in fact isn't the way the thing really is out there. That's not the way that situation really is, but you've got that in your material from which you're making your models. That's certainly going to foul you up. And if we're thinking in terms of a higher level of explanation, where we've got models down here, if you have among the various models that you're trying to put together for a generalization, a model that's incorrect, that can certainly foul you up. You have 6 models for different areas, and you're integrating these, and one of them's wrong, the model you make then is going to be fouled up. The result of faulty data is that the data that you've got won't fit the proper model. That is a model that actually reflects how things are. Another data problem you can have, even assuming that you don't have any of those, and I think probably for most of us in most areas we're working, there's going to be some faulty data. And the big problem is how to find it. And not easy. Another problem would be too little data. Too little data. We can get too little data from various ways. One way, we may have all the data that's known to mankind at that point in history when we're doing our work, and that amount happens to be too little to actually construct an accurate model. Or we might be ignoring some critical data that actually exists, it's known to man somewhere, and for some reason, we don't know it. That's especially dangerous in interdisciplinary work, because who can know everything? And so here we have a problem. Here we're trying to construct a model for some area, but we don't have enough information. We either have ignored some that exists, or there's just not enough in existence to actually give a result. Now, it's at this point that Occam's razor becomes very, very dangerous. Back in the old days, even my father used to do it, they used to shave with straight razors. And straight razors are very nice because they can shave a lot closer than the other razors are. But they're very dangerous. If you don't watch what you're doing, you can cut your throat. And Occam's razors like that too. Used properly, it can weed out a lot of stuff that you could spend all your time investigating and not worthwhile. On the other hand, if you're in an area where you have too little data really to get a good picture of what's going on, but you make various models and then you choose the simplest one may be far too simple to actually fit what's going on and not look anything like what the real situation is, though it looks like what little bit of information you've got. Well, that can certainly be a danger to them. So data problems in model making can involve faulty data, and surely there's going to be some of that, and it can involve too little data, and that will vary from discipline to discipline. Some areas have been worked over long enough that probably not much more data is going to show up, though you don't know that for sure, of course, but feel like you've got quite a lot. Other areas, very, very little has been done. In cosmology, there's been a lot of work done, most of it in the last 50 years, perhaps. But I think you'd still have to say, in the air question of what the universe is like, such, we don't have a lot of information. And your cosmological theories often are based upon the exact value of constants that we're not sure we know very exactly. And you've only got about four constants you're working with, so you wonder whether there's enough information to really construct a satisfactory model. So data problems, faulty data, too little data. Believe it or not, there's another problem. Too much data. Most people, when they start out in a field, feel that's the basic problem. Too much data. The problem is that it's easy to overload the human mind, or at least feel like the human mind is overloaded. Most of us, when we start learning things, start learning Hebrew or Greek or something like that. Ah, good night. Why didn't these guys speak English like any sensible person would? But no, they spoke Hebrew and Greek, and the English were all scratching themselves in the north woods of Germany at that time. So, you see, to really get a fair picture of what a discipline is like, you really have to know an awful lot of this. And when you really think about it, the definition of a scholar in an area is not whether the person is really sharp or not, and it's not whether he's really right or not. It's whether he knows the data. If the person knows the data of the area, he's a scholar in that area, even if he's a crackpot. And if he doesn't know the data in that area, he's not a scholar, even if he is very sober and has a great methodology. He's got a great methodology, but nothing to apply to. You aren't likely to construct models that are worth much. But this problem of too much data is a very, very real one, particularly in sciences where there may be billions of measurements or potential measurements have been made in various things and trying to decide what to do with it. In science, at least, and I suppose this is true in the other disciplines, there's a tendency to try and figure out how to simplify the data a little bit to make a tentative model. And say, well, let's ignore this, let's ignore that. Think of trying to explain the falling object, and you say, well, let's see if we can ignore friction. Friction's a very important thing in falling objects. But let's see if we can ignore friction and figure out how to do that, and then begin to make a model that explains how the fall operates. And if you can once get that model put together, maybe you can then put this friction back in and begin to explain the more complicated situation. Well, you can see that's a rather dangerous procedure because you may not be able to withdraw something and see how it would be otherwise. If you can experiment, you perhaps can do a little of that. If you can't experiment, you're in trouble. So that, I think, can be a real problem as well. But in many, many areas, we're faced with the problem of too much data and trying to figure out how to get a handle on it. You want to simplify in a certain way and see if you can get a handle, and then unsimplify such some way and see if you can get another handle. I guess you have to get footholds after that. But whatever you can do, try and get back. Well, having said these things about levels of explanation and data problems and such, let's come back then to model selection, not as it is ideally, but as it must be pragmatically. Model selection idealized, model selection pragmatized, we might say. Instead of requiring the model fit the data, most people are satisfied if it adequately fits the data. In fact, every theory I know anything about, I don't know much about that many, I suppose, their problem, data related to it. You say, well, that's your theory, but what do you do about this and this and this and this? And you say, well, I suspect that fellow mismeasured that, and perhaps there's another phenomenon operating here. But your theory, which is stupid, it fits those three things, but it doesn't do anything with these 25 over here. And so basically, when you actually get into model making, you wind up with something that adequately fits the data, and that's a judgment call, of course. And we're not saying that, you know, it's everyone take their choice, and all of the models are equally good, or all of them fit. Maybe none of them fit. But one would try to make some judgment on which one is better among the models that exist, and trying to reach a goal. That is, try to find out how things really are. It's very strange today. Many people in investigative disciplines don't seem to be particularly concerned how things really are. They're sort of concerned, well, this is a model that is satisfactory to our cultural outlook or something like that. That's really rather foolish in the long run. I think investigative disciplines are supposedly trying to find out what's really there. If they aren't, why bother to take data? Make much more satisfactory theories without looking at data. Far simpler. You can therefore master a lot many more fields if you use simple theories. I'd sure prefer using Newton's physics to Einstein's any day, or certainly than quantum mechanics. But it doesn't fit the data once you get into the small scale or the high speeds or high gravity, things of that variety. So, first thing, model selection, and pragmatically carried out, is that it must adequately fit the data, and there's no rule for adequate, okay? Usually some kind of comparison, the alternatives that are known to be available. Secondly, sort of a replacement for Occam's razor, is a feeling that the model ought to be economical in some way. Not economical in the size of the government grant, though if you're in a low grant area, you may have to work in that direction too. But the idea that your particular model has very few ad hoc features, very few things stuck on just to explain two or three pieces of data that don't really have any integral fit with the rest of the model. So ought to be economical with few ad hoc features. It's interesting to speculate why people want to operate that way. One might say it's nothing more than a desire to look at the simple theories first, and not until they are blown out of the water by data that doesn't fit do you move on to the more complex theories. Perhaps one could argue that it's a feeling that the universe really is at base simple to a certain extent. I'm not sure as Christians we have much warrant for saying it's really at base simple. Our picture of God is that he is not simple at all, he's quite complicated. And we shouldn't expect him to make things very simple. But we might expect him to make things beautiful and economical, things of that variety. So perhaps from a Christian perspective, we could see a reason for doing that. And pragmatically, likewise, I think we would say that our model selection would be tentative. We feel that, well, it adequately fits the data, but it doesn't fit all the data. Maybe something else will come up that really fits all of it we know about. There are probably a couple scientific endeavors where a theory can be said to fit all the data in that particular area. Sure, I wouldn't want to press that too hard, but quantum electrodynamics, there's some feeling in that direction. At least there was when I was in graduate school. Maybe they've changed their mind now. That it should really fit together, be beautiful, economical, etc. But tentative in the sense that new data may show up, and that new data may show that we have to go in a somewhat different direction. And perhaps one could say, you don't just say, well, you know, who cares? All this work we've done for three generations in developing this model, it may all blow out, go down the drain tomorrow. I don't think that'll happen in a well-constructed model, but it may turn out that that's only a simplified form of the model that when you get more data has to be reworked. But certainly the tentativeness then would be very tentative if you've got very little information, but still somewhat tentative even if you've got a great deal of information. You would have some a feeling on how tentative the model should be and how much you should build on top of it, higher level models, on the basis of whether you've got enough information to really pin yourself down that particular direction. Well, we've got to rush onward. This talk, allegedly to stay in somewhere in the boundaries of an hour, order of magnitude an hour, I guess we're all right, is scientific model making and biblical exegesis. Let's look at biblical exegesis then. Well, turns out that ideally anyway, biblical exegesis is an investigative discipline. And exactly the same pattern of model making applies to biblical exegesis as applies to investigative disciplines of other sorts, whether they be scientific, whether they be areas of liberal arts, whatever. That doesn't mean everybody does it this way, but that's also true in your other disciplines. Not everybody constructs their models by careful looking at the data. So the data in exegesis is going to be the text of the Bible. Naturally, some supplementary aids are necessary on types of figures of speech and things of that variety. And this warns us, I think, of something that's actually true in all investigative model making, not just in exegesis. And that is, it's already interdisciplinary, even when you get started. It's not that you can put down two brick walls, four brick walls, I guess, and a floor and a ceiling, and say, my data is inside here, and I'm not going out, and I'm going to make it airtight, etc. There are no disciplines, not even mathematics. I'm probably challenged on that, but there are no disciplines, not even mathematics, that are really airtight, that you don't really have to depend upon information from other sources, even for your basic work. So the date of the Bible, with these supplementary aids from grammar, history, geography, etc. And then you go through this structure. You read the biblical passages. Perhaps we're trying to exegete a passage, or perhaps we're trying to understand some biblical doctrine. Let's start with passage first. That makes the data a little more manageable. Have your data is that passage. And you look at it, and you try and draw from the statements of that passage some general statements that can be made. And then you try to intuit some kind of model that explains what the writer is talking about at that point. And you make some deductions from what he's talking about. And if that's what he's talking about, these things follow. And then take yourself back to the biblical passage and ask, do those things fit with the passage you started out with? So this basically carries out the same sort of a scheme. Cyclic structure again means there's a certain self-checking to it. There's no experiments as such in exegesis, though I suppose one could argue that disasters that have occurred in the history of interpretation should be somewhat instructive. A person standing on a hill in white shirts in 1844 waiting for the rapture, and it didn't come, should cause you to be somewhat more careful when you decide that Daniel is teaching that in 1982 the rapture will occur, and you guys are going to move out there in 1982. The 1844 guys were only wrong on their date. They weren't wrong on their basic idea that that's taught, that sort. So you might say there's some experiment in a sense of that direction, what we might call disasters in the history of exegesis. The prediction can certainly be valuable in self-checking too, particularly when you move from exegeting one passage to exegeting all of the passages on that general subject. And then a prediction, if he's talking about this, then this ought to follow, but in fact that's contradicted by this statement in another location is talking about that. Well, something is awry then with your model constructed, and you need to do something about it. So a prediction can certainly be valuable. We might wonder whether we can get any added data in this area. No experiment, exactly. We do get some prediction, and that certainly can be valuable. But do you like in your scientific areas or other areas you ever get added data? Well, now and then new manuscripts show up, and once in a while they might suggest following a text different than what had been followed. I think we can fairly say that that's what happened in the 19th century, where there was a move from the text which had been around since the Renaissance to a text which felt to be based on earlier manuscripts, but I'm not going to get into Textus Receptus controversy here. However, there's another valuable source of new data, if you like, in doing biblical exegesis, and that is the second time around you may notice things you never noticed before. That is, you're having constructed a tentative model, made predictions from it, and brought them back to look at the data may suggest passages that you didn't think were related to that subject. But now, if that prediction is correct, they are related, and do these passages support what you say or not? So you can see how at least the area of prediction and the area of added data may be helpful in the area of biblical exegesis. Levels of explanation are also important here, as they are in any investigative discipline. I would say a proper way to operate, although of course we're not operating in a vacuum, is that you start with each passage of the Bible, and you construct a model about what it's talking about. Naturally, any one individual living only 100 years or less is not going to have a chance to do that, perhaps in detail. And then each of these models becomes the data for trying to construct a doctrine. All of the models of what Paul, Jesus, John, Malachi, and such are talking about in various passages relating to some question, say the nature of the Lord's return or something, are then brought together. And you try and construct some higher level models on what will the order of events be, or can we tell when it will occur, and what are the relation of various types of people to these events and things of that sort. So we might say the first cycle of this would be exegesis of individual passages, and then coming up onto a higher level of explanation, models based on what these passages are talking about are used together to construct doctrines. Doctrines here, there are many different doctrines in eschatology and many different doctrines in soteriology and things of that variety. So you're going to have a hierarchy of the same sorts of things. Might mention in a somewhat different scheme, though it's related in the sense of questions of levels of causality, perhaps, rather than level of explanation, we need to realize that there might be passages that look contradictory, but they're in fact looking at different points on the level of explanation. You might think two scientists disagreed totally when you asked a meteorologist, what makes it rain? And he says, the thermal gradient in the atmosphere, acting on humid air rising in the atmosphere, it makes it rain. And you talk to a particle physicist, and he said, the presence of ionized particles in the cloud make it rain. And you talk to a nuclear physicist, he said, no, it's nuclear fusion in the thing. Those guys don't know what they're talking about. They all gave different answers. Now, that's been a common explanation for what happened when David made a military census of the nation of Israel. One passage tells us Satan caused it, and another passage tells us God caused it. Liberal theologians say, Bible writers couldn't agree on the matter, know what they were talking about. In fact, you can see that very easily as a hierarchy of causation. God, working all things together for good, causing even the wrath of man and presumably Satan to praise him, used the wickedness of Satan to put into the heart of David this desire for the thing. And we asked who took the census, caused the census. You could say God caused the census. You could say Satan caused the census. You could say David caused the census. You could say Joab, I think he's the guy, caused the census. But I guarantee you, not one of those guys went around knocking on doors. They had guys below them. You had a whole chain of causality working, and the marvel of it is that the morality of each of those actors is preserved in their activity. Satan is sinning in causing David to do it. God is not sinning in causing David to do it. David is sinning in causing Joab to do it. I don't know exactly what Joab is doing in doing it, but you have all of this still functioning there. It's a picture of a levels of causality of which all of them are true. I got off the subject there a little bit, but it has something vaguely to do with what we're talking about. What about data problems in regard to biblical exegesis? Do we have any data problems? Well, I think we can have a problem with faulty data. I believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, so I don't think there's any faulty data in the autographs, but there's a possibility that here and there the autographs may have been miscopied. And there may be places where either the original reading does not now exist. I think there's a possibility of that in the question of how old Saul was when he began to reign, 1 Samuel. But I don't think there are many of those. But maybe miscopied, maybe mistranslated. Anybody who's done any work with original language is quite satisfied that there are hundreds of mistranslations in any single version of the Bible. Now, of course, when you get 10 of those guys together on a committee, they're going to vote. And you'll still have everybody on the committee will think there are hundreds of them in the one that they prepared because they didn't do it themselves. Only way to be satisfied that there aren't any is to do it all yourself. And that doesn't really solve the problem. That just satisfies you, maybe. So that can happen. And, of course, you can misunderstand. There's the passage in front of you. You may misread it. One might argue for exegesis, however, on the lowest level, that's really faulty induction or faulty intuition rather than faulty data. But certainly, if you're working with a translation and it's been mistranslated, or you're working with a text, and the choice you made on the reading at that point is not the actual reading in the autograph, whether it be one of the others that's right in front of you, but you didn't like it for some reason, you still may have a problem with faulty data there. When you move up to the next level, you're now taking the exegesis of dozens of passages and you were trying to fit them together into a doctrine. A very fruitful source of faulty data can be bad exegetical models for various of the passages that you've been working with. So you've decided Paul meant this in the passage, but that isn't what he meant. And so when you get around to putting together his statements on that subject, or not just his statements, the biblical statements on that particular subject, why, lo and behold, your model is messed up because you misunderstood what he said on that particular level. So when you're making doctrines, your problem of bad exegesis, yours or somebody else's, whether you read several commentaries and decided that one was the nicest one, that may happen. Another type of data problem, in exegesis as well, may be too little data. Now, 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17 assures us that all scripture is inspired by God, profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, training in righteousness, that the man of God might be adequate, complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. That does not necessarily tell us that there will be enough data for us to settle every question in the biblical material. I think it does tell us that we have all we need to know about all we need to know. But we don't need to know everything, and so we may not have those particular matters. There may be answers that can be gotten from other sources that God has not chosen, therefore, to reveal to us, because we can get them from those sources. It's not crucial that we have that. Now, it's fair to say, by reading over the Bible many, many times, that we can get a general idea of basically what we need to know, and what we need to know is basically the area of theology. What God is like, what man is like, what sin is like, how do we get back to God? Salvation history, what has God done in history? How is he working? What does this tell us about him? We need to know things in the area of righteous living. What kind of a life does God want us to have? Those sorts of things are basically what the Bible is about. And it's fair to say that in general, the Bible has rather little in the various academic disciplines we may be working in. That doesn't follow that it has nothing, or that we can ignore what it has to say in these particular areas. But it may be so. We do need to realize, however, that though the Bible is basically about theology, we might say, who God is and what he's done and things of that variety, it has very, very little information on several questions that would be very interesting to know the answers to. We might like to know something about the creation of the angels. And as far as I can tell, the Bible only tells us that they're created. It doesn't tell us when. There have been several suggestions to put them in creation week at various points. I'm inclined to put them before creation week, because I think creation week is about our universe, and I don't know how to define universe exactly, but the Bible doesn't even tell us about something that we're going to be involved in forever, and that is the nature of the eternal state. It tells us something about it. It doesn't tell us a lot about it. It tells us it's a very good thing if we have trusted in Christ, if we're depending on his righteousness alone. We will therefore be judged righteous by him when he comes, and it will be great. But we still don't understand much about it. We don't understand what will happen to entropy, if anything will happen to entropy in the eternal state. We don't know whether our training in literature or linguistics or things will be of any use, whether we'll have to scrap it all. I spent all this time learning Urdu, and that isn't the language they're going to use in the eternal state. Well, I don't know. We don't know. There's not enough data. Of course, trying to find out whether there's enough data for something, you really have to look at all the data and see what it's about. Is there any problem with too much data in the Bible? It's hard to imagine that there could be too much data in a book. It's only, it's not even 2,000 pages long here. And they started renumbering, I think, here somewhere. But the main text only runs a little over 1,500 pages here. It's hard to imagine that there could be too much data when it all fits in one book, although if you start memorizing it, you'll begin to get the idea maybe there is. But when you start thinking about the number of relationships that can exist between this number of sentences there are in the Bible, and the number of words there are and things like that, you realize that very quickly even that amount of data becomes very staggering, very much of an overload to people. And I think charitably, one can say that at least one problem with the disagreement among Christians over what the Bible teaches is there's so much material that if some people emphasize one aspect and ignore another aspect or play down another aspect, they're going to get a very different picture than people who emphasize the aspect the other group ignored and vice versa. So basically, I think we can see one area there. Well, this morning, we've tried to look basically then at what we might call model making. Looked at model making, called scientific model making, or model making of investigative disciplines, and then tried to carry it over to model making in biblical interpretation. I want to go on next time and look at some theological considerations we need to deal with, and then finally to try and put things together. So I'll be glad to try and answer questions and listen to observations and things of that variety, though naturally I've got some things I won't talk about, haven't talked about yet, so I don't know how to answer some of your questions. You may think I'm dodging them when I say I'm going to talk about that later, and I may be. You'll have to find out, see whether I'm secretly up at night adding new material to my talk or places. But any remarks, questions? Yes, sir.
what you have on the screen there is really a model for model banking, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. And if it's wrong, boy.
It would seem to me that this model could be made a more efficient model of what goes on if we allow for some feedback.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this model does not take account of all the data and is therefore simplified. There are several places here where there might be immediate feedback. One might look back and forth from the generalizations to the data. In fact, you do that to see whether you're making generalizations right. And I don't know how you intuit back and forth, but one might simply, it might be tempted to at least say, well, that idea I thought of doesn't even fit the generalization. You know, you can get some feedback here. And deduction, certainly, I don't know about verbal logic, but certainly in physics, I would be very careful to run a computer program making deductions on something and not try and check whether I had done the computations right or something like that. So you'd certainly have something there. Yeah, I think it's fair to say you'd have a certain amount of feedback, and one might even look across here and say, whoop, that prediction disagrees with that generalization, you know, it contradicts that generalization or something. See how there might be short circuits across it in several places. The kind of short circuit I think you want to avoid is zap and run with your model without ever looking at the data again.
Historically, we have had situations where data that didn't fit led to very important discoveries.
That's right. That's right. I think we find, too, that, as you suggested there, the phenomenon that the outsider who is not a specialist in that area looking in finds it rather disturbing. The layman effect, if you like. Why do these people disagree on this? Don't they know what they're doing, etc.? Because much of your public relations regarding academics is, you know, well, these people know more. They ought, therefore, to be more certain on things. But the more you know, the more data you have to deal with also makes more questions. And we hope, perhaps, if you knew more and more and more and more, it'd converge back again. But we're apparently not on that side of the curve yet, because we're, I don't think we ever will be until the Lord straightens out or something. And it's particularly distressing when you're in an area and you're trying to use data from some other discipline, and you know there's disagreement among those guys on what the data is, particularly the models or something like that. And you say, well, why don't you guys straighten it out so I can get on it and you know, do the synthesis? And perhaps it shows us one of the whole problems. Man kind of wants to have it all together, but we're not smart enough to have it all together. So we have to depend on each other, we have to depend upon the Lord, etc. And that makes us feel uncomfortable. Wow, makes me feel uncomfortable. Let's see, over here.
I wonder if you have some practical observation. See my question?
Oh, yes. It's a very, very difficult problem. I think every one of us face it in dealing with lay people that we have contact with.
In you have some sage advice for your students when they ask questions.
A piece of sage advice I'm going to give in the third lecture, which I'll mention now, I'll probably use it all up now, I won't have anything to do with the third lecture, is basically a matter of balance. The Bible is very clear that there's enough information for a person who uses his means carefully, honestly, to come to a sufficient knowledge of the truth. But there's enough complication that even the most brilliant people can spend all their lives studying and they won't know it all. And when we say know it all, it isn't like, well, I know all important things, but there's only a few minor things out on the edge I don't know. I think the biblical picture is there are a lot of important things we don't know, but every one of us has got plenty of room to have to depend upon the Lord and have to seek to do it His way, use His methodology. But on the other hand, we have no right, laymen or experts, no right to sit back and take it easy, like well, I've done what's important, I don't need to work any harder. And I think one big problem we have is a mentality in churches that does not encourage laymen to think. Laymen who don't have training can be concerned about as basic things as other people can. They may not have the time or the opportunity or the talent to thoroughly investigate areas. The rest of the church, because it's a use of our gifts together, have a responsibility to try and give them what is good information, and not be misleading them, and not leaving them with no guidance. And, of course, we're going to have a problem that a person who comes on more strongly can outbid you on something, so to speak, though he doesn't know what he's talking about. And you may have a tough time making it clear to someone else he doesn't know what he's talking about, because the fellow that you're trying to convince
Here's the guy that you think doesn't know what he's talking about, and here's you, you think you know what you're talking about, and there's the other guy watching you. The other fellow might be a clever debater, or the person out there may not know enough information to be able to judge between the two of you. Well, that's happened all through history. I mean, the judgments made on whether it was Jesus or the Pharisees that were right. A lot of the common people made some good judgments, but an awful lot of them just followed the Pharisees and say that is a problem that we'll get into with theological considerations next time. My suggestion is that we need a good deal more humility than we often have, particularly in circles where there's a tendency in that direction. But we've got to be very careful about going the other direction. Everybody's ideas are as good as anybody else's, or we've got Satan on one side, trying to complicate things, trying to make things very dangerous, succeeding. And so I would say some kind of a middle road that recognizes our shortcomings and that at the same time recognize our responsibilities. But I do think there's responsibility to get laymen to think. And I think you find an awful lot of them will enjoy it once they do it. Maybe a pastor would give you slightly different advice and be more warranted for giving it. But I've had some experience, I think, with people who had not done much thinking and started in it. It helped them.
In the matter of exegesis and translation, on occasion the result is a word or words which totally satisfy the scholars and which miscommunicate to the layman.
Bible translation is a whole different ballgame almost. It's not so much a question of investigation, though it's certainly a question of investigation, also a question of communication. And translating the Bible is not just a question of finding out what it says, that's certainly important, it's also a question of trying to communicate that in intelligible ways. And in fact, you have great disagreement in Bible circles on how you do that. Do you do it as literally as you can, so that people who know Greek can understand what's going on in English, and they can even tell you what Greek word is behind it, or do you do it rather paraphrastically, so that the person reading it gets a good idea what the translator's thought was meant there, but may not even have a clue that there's another alternative that wouldn't read that way at all. So I don't know a solution to that. It's somewhat parallel to the problem of communication in sciences and such. Every discipline, not just science, every investigative discipline has got its own jargon. If you want people who aren't trained in that discipline to know what you're talking about, you can't use the jargon, unless you're going to train them in the jargon. You've got to go very slowly for that. Average person cannot handle a paragraph with five words in it they've never heard of, even though you've given them, you've got the definition up the top of the page. Now you're going to start using it. The person keeps going back and forth. They're not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Maybe a diligent person or the persevering type will do it. So that's a real problem. It doesn't directly involve the investigation, but involves the question of how you communicate it and how you communicate a disagreement on a couple of things and put it back in the text. In the King James, it's very common to represent the genitives by something of something, John of Thaddeus or something like that. And modern translations will generally try and pick the use of the genitive they think it is and explain it. Then, of course, cutting out the other alternatives, but at least it reads easier for the average reader then. I don't know a complete solution. I think probably the best solution is to have several Bible translations, some of which are designed to be rather technical, literal, and some of which are designed to be rather free. And the free ones are used for reading with understanding by a congregation or an individual or something aloud, so a person who's never heard the Bible before can figure what's going on. And the other used for careful study by a person who doesn't have the original languages. Gotten off the subject? Well, not too much, I guess. Let's see. How about over here?
You say he starts with the model because he has a certain thing. And then he gathers data from the Bible. Say he's got 15 scriptures to support that idea. Would he bypass every one of those steps in doing it?
Depends on the person, of course. This is one of the real complications that has existed, and yet I don't think it's something you can get away from. I don't think science solves the problem totally, although they try, but there are an awful lot of people with pet theories in science. They're never going to change. They're going to die. And their students might not carry on their theory, but in fact, in any of these investigative things, you tend to get a institutionalization of certain models, and then a handling of the data in terms of those models. Well, it's okay if the model is right, but it's bad if the model is wrong. See, that's the feature. Because we're really talking about a world that exists, you get the benefits of having the right model even if you got it by a crummy way, and you get the disadvantages of having the wrong model even if you did it in a very sophisticated way as carefully as you could. It's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. If a person is really trusting in Christ alone, though has never investigated things carefully, he has that benefit. There may be a lot of disadvantages with other things in through his life, but that's the way the real world is. If a person thinks he can fly by all the studies he's made, because he's better aerodynamically equipped than a bumblebee, and a bumblebee can fly, and he steps out a second window and waves his arms, he's going to experience the same result, or rather the same as somebody that accidentally stepped out that window and didn't think he could fly. So you walk across the bridge and you think it'll hold your weight. If you think so for the wrong reason, it was made by your brother-in-law, and you kind of trust him. Then if it holds up, you're okay, even though that was a crummy reason. And if you've done a careful structural analysis of it, but in fact you overlooked one minor point, that the thing caves in on you, you get this disadvantage. I think that situation with a layman, in a sense, is the same advantage or disadvantage as a non-lay person. A little bit about that in Ecclesiastes, too, in regard to the wise and the foolish both die. It's an advantage to be wise. You at least know what you're doing. You have light. But I think we see that here as well.
As I read the history of the conflicts between science and the church, we'll say, many of those conflicts were a problem with the church not realizing that their model of biblical exegesis was tentative.
No question. And again, here's an area we have to be careful. It's very clear from the action of people who are commended in Scripture that it's possible to be too tentative about things that are clearly taught in Scripture. For a great danger. But on the other hand, it's possible to be so certain about things that aren't really taught there that you can muck things up that way too. And that's got to be a judgment, and it's got to be a judgment on how much information there is and whether one thinks that that is what the writer is intending to convey when he says that. Or whether that's just a possible way of understanding something that he's really talking about something else. That I think we have to watch for. And that should be the case in all academic disciplines. A person's going to be very serious question about whether he's going to grant you a doctorate, say. He works in a university. You believe the Earth is flat, and you're trying to get a doctorate in astrophysics, you know, or in astronomy, or something like that. You say, those guys are biased. I have a perfect right to believe the Earth is flat. You do, but a doctorate, in a sense, commends you as one that they think knows what you're doing. There's always some level on that. There are many people who've gotten doctorates from a school that the school wished they hadn't given them, but they can't cancel them now, I guess. We've got to see that does occur. That occurs in theological circles, that occurs in scientific circles as well. Other areas of investigation. Just something we have to put up with, I guess.
Isn't there a danger, especially in evangelical Christianity, where we try to prioritize models by people that we want to emulate, or people we regard as scholars or leaders?
Yeah, that happens in science, too. Certainly, Newton's views on certain areas had an influence for several centuries. One might even argue too long in some areas. It's been argued that some of his views on light interfered with a development of wave theory of light. And although there's a sense in which some features of Newton's views were later picked up in quantum theory, yet they weren't based largely on his observations, but were based on things that were observed further down the line. Yet Newton's influence caused that not to be examined too thoroughly. Certainly Aristotle's influence and the influence of some of the other thinkers of the classical period had a very strong influence on the church's holding on to certain things, although Aristotle wasn't a Christian, and it just had become traditionalized within the group. That's a danger in any type of work of this sort. A person's position and his brilliance and such may cause his views to be received in a way that is far beyond what the data warrants.
I think you define model as a representation.
Yeah, no one would claim that the model is the reality. Even though they may claim that there's a one-for-one correspondence as far as it goes. My model isn't the universe. My model is some kind of description, okay?
How does this tie in with theory?
Theory, hypothesis, etc., all, I should have said something about that, are all understood here to be synonymous terms. I don't make a distinction between law, theory, hypothesis, etc., as different levels. That is done in some terminology. And I'm using model as kind of a broader term to represent the whole category. Some of them may be felt to be very solid, and others very tentative, but they're all models. The difference between it and generalization is an attempt to link together logically or structurally in some way a number of general statements, whereas the general statements themselves, I'm not sure you can make up. So I can't tell you much about what Occam thought about the matter, sort of thing. But I think the danger on the one hand is that if you use it, you will make something far simpler than the reality, and therefore not a good representation. But if you don't use it, you essentially have an infinity of much more complicated... It's almost like saying, here's a set of data that can be fit by an infinity of models, but you can make a boundary by trying to come down to the simplest of those, and then work up as the data forces you to. Now, of course, there's nothing to tell you that that's not going to be a crucial question that you have to know the answer of before you die, and that you're going to be able to find the answer to that before you die. The universe doesn't make promises to us regarding how things have got to work out if we make mistakes. You know, they're going to work out good anyway. Now, God promises that for those who trust in Him, but Job, the disasters that happened to Job are good in, from that perspective, so...
I wonder if you give us an example too of what a model might look like that is the outcome or the product of biblical exegesis.
Suppose we take Psalm 1, whip out one of my sermons here. What is the psalmist talking about here? He's making a distinction between two types of persons. How is he structuring what he's doing? Some people would say, well, he's structuring it the first half of the psalm he's talking about the righteous, and the last half of the psalm he's talking about the wicked. I would say, no, that structure doesn't fit the data that well. How about he's contrasting the righteous and the wicked all through the whole psalm, but the first part he's talking about where they get their information from, and the second part he's talking about what difference it makes here and now, and the third part he's talking about what difference it makes when you die. And there are two slightly different ways of structuring, that is, two different models for what is going on in that psalm. And basically, you go back to the data and you see whether the one model or the other model fits in each different statement made. Now, that would even be a somewhat higher level model. It's a model for the whole psalm, not a model for one sentence of the psalm. For instance, in whatever he does, he prospers, the last line of verse 3. Is that to be translated as leaving the figure of the tree planted by the streams of water and coming back to the person? Or is it to be translated in quite a different way, whatever it produces, it brings to maturity, as staying with the figure of the tree and saying the tree has healthy leaves, and when it produces fruit, the fruit don't drop off halfway through the season before they're ripe, they make it all the way to ripeness, etc. There are two models, alternative models for a line of the psalm, and two alternative models, of which are doubtless more, for the structure of the psalm, etc., okay? And so you can see there might be piles of different kinds of models for limited features, and then as you begin to put those together to try and get a bigger and bigger picture of what's going on, what's the place of the psalm and the whole book of psalm? Is it an introduction of some variety? Does it have any relationship to Psalm 2? Psalm 1, I think, is a picture of what life for the individual is all about. Psalm 2 is a picture of what life for the society is all about. What is God doing in history in Psalm 2? What is God doing in individual lives in Psalm 1? They both form an introduction for a very personal and corporate type of a relationship to God that's seen all through the Psalms. Again, looking at suggested models for what's going on there. Then as you begin to put together what God is doing or what the writer is doing in various passages, you then begin to come around and say, what does the Bible have to say about the coming of the Lord? What's it going to be like? When will it occur? How will it occur? What will its relationship be to the believer? When will the rapture be? When will the tribulation be? When will the millennium be? Higher and higher levels, of which there may be more and more passages relate in various ways. So that's kind of what I'm trying to say further on that.
Just the difficulty, it seems like at certain points in your illustration, it's hard to distinguish between the generalization and the model.
Okay, yeah.
You kind of like put several things in the category, general lump there.
Okay. I will concede that a weak part of this diagram is this distinction. There really are things that unify a great many observations that are much more detailed than saying stars shine or something like that. Okay. There's some sort of a balance here anyway, but I'm not sure I can make this nice and satisfactory thing here. For instance, you might argue that in the second level, the models aren't data. They're generalizations for the next model. Have I helped much? Just confuse things. Well, sorry. I think there's a tendency for all of us to think that the constructs of our mind bear a relationship to reality that's closer than it actually is. But that's what we've got to work with, and that's the responsibility we've got. But we need humility, on the other hand, to see that we may be messed up rather thoroughly if we don't keep in mind That certainly has happened in church history frequently, where someone has so connected a certain interpretation with Christianity that when that interpretation proves to be faulty, they've thrown out Christianity. And some of the conflicts between science and Christianity, I think, fall in that category. Persons who would reject Christianity because they believe the Bible teaches the earth is flat, or that the sun goes around the earth, or things of that variety.
I was thinking along the lines of analogical thinking, if I can use that term, try to draw analogies.
Yes. Might be rather interesting to see how the Bible, in fact, uses models to give us a picture of God. God is a shepherd, God is a father, God is the potter, etc. Models which have at least a limited range of validity and allow us to understand certain things about a God that we can't directly understand from the activities of men whom we have contact with and see every day, things of that sort. Well,
Occam's razor, and your response that it's a good place to start.
I don't think there's any question that there's an important pedagogical method of starting with simple, basic things and working out the more complexities. Of course, doing that assumes we know the complexities well enough to be able to make a simplification that's accurate rather than one that's really badly awry. But certainly, we've got to start somewhere. And it seems easier to start with the simple and work up if we can, though we may have to concede that we're really going to have to change our models. I like to think of the teaching model regarding who discovered America. In elementary school, we learn it was Columbus. In high school, we learn it was Leif Erikson. And in graduate school, we learn that the Indians were here all the time. I think it's fair to say that that's the way we've got to start. In other words, we've got to try and get a handle on things and work into it. It may turn out, after we've worked on it a while, that the direction we came in from was very bad. But if the method is self-checking and correcting, etc., we might still wind up over in the vicinity of what's really true, even though we started out from a rather poor starting place. There can be a great danger here of starting out with too many assumptions that will rule out your ever getting to the right solution. I think of one of the cosmologists today, Fred Hoyle. He says, the idea I use in cosmological investigations is that nothing was impressed on the universe from outside. All of the things arise naturally from within the universe. The universe is self-explanatory only. And that assumption, if you hold to it tenaciously enough, will, I believe, keep you from understanding the universe, because that isn't the way it happened, taking God's view of the matter. I have some warrant for that from Scripture, but we do have danger in that direction. And yet, certainly, because of this too much data problem, we really do have to come into things and try to simplify the thing enough to make some understanding of it, and then put the stuff back in. And we not only use a pedagogical method, but investigation sometimes follows that line. Of course, you're aware that in your own field, quite often, the direction an investigation took and the direction you take in teaching it might still be quite different. Blundered through some very complicated theories, perhaps, that weren't really close at all. Quite often, I would say it's unusual in an astronomy course, for instance, to teach the Ptolemaic theory as a way to work into the Copernican theory. Teach, well, the planets appear to go across the sky like that, and the epicycles and all of that. Usually they're mentioned if you have a little short section on history of astronomy, but you don't teach it that way. But still, the teaching from the simple and then trying to build in the complexity is certainly valuable. Okay, been a long morning. Why don't we fold it up then and come back this afternoon.
This has been a presentation of IBRI, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. This series is continued on the next cassette.